of Alexander Schmemann. I just think what he has done from the Eastern Orthodox perspective and his capacity to write in a way that's accessible to Christians of all theological traditions is quite extraordinary. You'll hear me reference Alexander Schmemann later on this afternoon, but his book, For the Life of the World, is a classic. And really, for anybody interested in sacramental theology and piety, I think it's just an essential part of your theological library. And as I said, he's Eastern Orthodox, but he represents, in a very interesting way, he's Russian Orthodox, lived for many years as an emigre in France, and then he became an American and was the dean, which is the chief officer of St. Vladimir Seminary, north of New York City. And really, part of his genius is to be Orthodox, but thoroughly Russian, French, and American. So you have somebody who writes out of the genius of those of the sensibilities that have been formed in those cultural settings in which he's been. And I think that's part of the strength of the book. He writes in a way that's highly accessible, and I'll be referencing him when I come to the insistence on joy in the meal. Another book that I could commend to you of his is By Water and Spirit, which is really his theology of baptism. Also, I commend it to you. And even though many of us in this room would practice believer's baptism, his book, For Water and Spirit, is really, it forms the whole meaning of baptism, whether or not you're a pedo-baptist or not. One of the things that I find noteworthy in his book on water and the spirit, his argument, I think it's there, not here, that when a child is baptized, the Orthodox, he insists, although I think he's pushing them that way, the child is baptized not on the basis of the faith of the parents, but on the basis of the faith of the church. And I found that meaningful, to realize just how frequently I need to lean into the faith of the church when my own faith seems weaker. Where do I turn? Well, the faith of a friend. But it's the faith of the church that carries the day, which is why for me the creeds are a vital part of worship, because in saying the creeds, I'm entering into something that is believed by somebody far bigger than me. My salvation does not rise or fall on my own level of faith. And that's been very much part of my upbringing. By faith I am saved, so it's my faith, and here I go. And I need that corrective. I think this is a spectacular book by David Da Silva. Sacramental Life, Spiritual Formation Through the Book of Common Prayer. Even if you don't pray with the BCP, even if you are not from the Church of England or the Anglican Church or the Episcopalian Church, you'll find this to be a magnificent exposition of sacramental spirituality, baptismal and Eucharistic, the Lord's Supper, but also he persuaded me that we need to think much more sacramentally about the practice of orders, holy orders, but also in particular marriage and wedding ceremonies. And so I think one of the I almost want to say desperately urgent needs. It is desperately urgent in my settings that we have some kind of appropriate rite to formalize a wedding, a marriage. Our rites in my country are unabashedly pagan, over the top pagan. And we just have not thought through what are appropriate rites. And if the shoe fits, wear it. But this is what we do. I know you do it, so I'm just being facetious at this point. The woman stands at the door. He stands here. She stands there with her father, male figure. He walks her up, gives her away to another male figure. How much more pagan can you get? Unbelievable. So we still are treating women as property in our marriage rites. That's just one piece. I could go on where I think our marriage rites are fundamentally pagan, not Christian. This is the best thing. Where else do you turn? Where is there a critical theological reflection on the rite of marriage? It just doesn't exist, except I commend to you this book. There.
I seem to remember in that Schmemann book that he talks about the Orthodox view of marriage and a wedding and being a little kingdom under the kingdomship of Christ.
Yeah.
And
yes.
Just that little phrase is
it's revolutionary.
Stuck with me.
Yeah. Now, where I differ with both of these sources is I don't think we should necessarily celebrate the Eucharist at a marriage, but that's another point. Now, to the subject at hand, I have two more themes that I need to address. Well, two. One's a dual theme, and then so it's three, but two that are going to be treated together. Remembrance and anticipation in this first hour, and Eucharist, but under Eucharist, I'm also going to address the theme of joy in the second hour this afternoon. But there's two other topics that I think need to come to the surface at some point, and it may be fitting that they come in right now before I move to the theme of remembrance and anticipation. At some point, we need to address the question of the location of the sacraments and who has the right to preside at the sacraments, and the two are intimately related. And I kind of jokingly said there over the lunch break that this may be, it should be the last thing I do so that I can head directly to the car and off to the airport, and maybe I won't get a ride anymore. And I can't win on this next point. Having said that, even though I can't win, it is important that I raise the question, not for my sake and our sake per se, but each of us needs to have some theological basis for both the location of the practice of the Lord's Supper and baptism, the location, and the location also suggests who has the authority to preside. And I suspect that right within this room, we've got the whole spectrum. So at the one end of the spectrum, you've got the Jesus movement that basically you can baptize anywhere, ideally on a coast in Southern California, that would be the ideal. And these are the sacred waters. And you baptize, I've got pictures of this, you're standing in the water all lined up, and the person in front of you baptizes you, you turn around and baptize the person behind you. And the only thing that, the only basis for, what authorizes you to baptize is that you are a baptized one. And so you're literally standing in the water baptizing the person behind you because the person ahead of you has now baptized you, and they have the authority to baptize you because they have now been baptized even if it was just moments before. So that's about as low church as you can get, the Jesus movement, 1960s and 70s, early 70s. High church, of course, the higher the church you go, you can go all the way up to only the bishop ultimately can baptize slash confirm, although most of the highest church, most even Anglo-Catholic, have moved to at least a priest can baptize, and now increasingly there are traditions that had been restrictive now, indeed, within the Roman Church, confirmation happens not exclusively by the bishop, but by the priest, but it is the clergy, and it is clergy that has been specifically ordained to the ministry of the word, but more to the point, really the make or break is the sacraments of baptism and the Lord's Supper. And most of us in this room are going to be somewhere in between. Now, where you come out on that typically resides in how sacramental anything is. That is, this is a sacramental question. You can't be high church sacramental and be low church when it comes to who's authorized to perform said sacraments. That in effect what happens is that if you believe that the bread and the cup and the water have some sacramental character to them, then more than likely you're going to move in this trajectory of recognizing there's a sacramental character to the ministry itself. And that is that the person who proclaims the word and presides at the table is sacramentally representing who? Christ. That is that Christ is sacramentally present to the community in the person who has been designated. In my own understanding and practice, that's why I think it is appropriate for the clergy to be in that moment of proclamation of the word. In my case, in Anglican communions, the most crucial place is not the word, but the crucial place, of course, is the sacrament. That in those moments, that the one who is in that position is vested. That is, there's something that is representing that for pro tem, for now, for this moment, they are in the Christ place. That is, they are not there indefinitely. That any more than we were going to have bread and cup, when we get to the kingdom that is yet to come, there's no more bread and cup because Christ is there. When we get to the kingdom that is yet to come, there is no ordained ministry because Christ is among us. But in the meantime, there's an ordained ministry where Christ brings us the ministry of the word. Christ is the ultimate preacher. And Christ presides at the table. Christ is the one that presides at the table. But somebody stands, what audacity for those of us that preside, somebody stands where Christ, properly speaking, would preside. On what basis? Because they are the Christ figure, you might say to us, pro tem. So who has the authority to stand in the place of Christ? To both bring the ministry of the word, but we'll bracket that one out for the moment. Who has the authority to preside at the table and declare, this is the bread of heaven. This is the cup of blessing. Who has the authority to serve? Who has that authority? Here's how I get there, and then I'll have some minimal conversation, but I think we could spend the whole afternoon on this, so I don't want to do that. It's a course on It's a seminar on sacramental spirituality, not on sacramental points of debate. But it is important to raise it. Here's my getting to it is in the following sequence. That these rites of baptism and the Lord's Supper do not belong to you and me. They belong, properly speaking, to the church. They belong to God, maybe I should say that, but they are located in the church. These are God's rites. These are God's acts. And Christ grants them to the church, baptism and the Lord's Supper, as a means by which we might know God's grace. So that in that sense, they are located within the church. They're not my personal rites. Christ didn't give them to me, he gave them to the church. And where the rub tends to come within my circles, Christ also did not give them to my family. This is not the Smith family that gathers at this table. It is the family of God. And that distinction is no small matter, because the basis for participation in the Holy Meal is not shared kinship or shared blood or shared name or shared tribe or clan. The basis of participation is our shared faith in Christ. And so it's, for me, it's dangerous terrain to get on to say, well, me at home, as the, I guess the father, I would be the one. No, I would not be Joella. Why would, on what basis do I preside at home? Because I'm the oldest or I'm the male? Or no, there's no other basis. One, the location of this rite is in the church, my contention. And then secondly, how do we decide within the church who has the capacity on behalf of the church and in the name of Christ to preside at this meal? And that's really what ordination is. So basically at that point, you go to your practices of ordination to say, we set aside one from among us. And I think the language of the book of Hebrews is fitting here. One does not choose this for oneself. One may have one desire and a sense of call to pastoral office and to ordained ministry, but ultimately it's the church that, in the name of Christ and in the power and anointing of the Spirit, sets aside one from among us to now preside at the table. Not one literally, but one that will be the one who now, in the name of Christ, pronounces that this is bread and cup. So in an Anglican setting, for example, Christmas Eve service on Little Main Island, we only have about 50 people, but it's a glorious service. Hosted by the Anglican Church, but all kinds of riffraff can show up, including me. And it's dramatically hospitable. Bless their hearts, the Anglicans want to be hospitable when it comes to the table and to the service. And the rector comes over by boat from another island. So they don't live on the island. She doesn't live on the, he doesn't, Rob Weatherford doesn't live on the island. So he comes over, but on that particular Christmas Eve, we had a terrible snowstorm, and there was no boat movement, and so they were going to cancel the service. But somebody said to me, aren't you a minister? You could host a Christmas Eve service, and we could have the Lord's Supper. And so they phoned them, and of course, what they learned is what? No, because he's not an Anglican. We can't just have any kind of, you know, I'm sure he's a delightful person that loves the Lord sincerely. Actually, if you really press them, I'm a schismatic. If you use Anglican, to use Anglicanese, I'm a schismatic. But that's another matter. Going back to, they look upon me, they know who I am. But he's not an ordained minister within the Anglican Church of Canada. So I don't have the authority to preside. So we had to move up the street to the community center and had a delightful service in which this person, the schismatic, presided. But there was no way that I could preside at the table. I could have preached the homily, but it's the sacrament itself that becomes the make or break point. And in my my read, I'm more than happy to honor that. That is, they're quite restrictive in a sense of who can preside at the table and who cannot. I'm going to move on to another topic. Yes?
The church I'm serving now, I've been serving there just a short time. But on Christmas Eve, pastor is there from, say, 5 to 7, and then people come by family and celebrate communion by families instead of a gathering of the church. What do you think about that?
What do you think I'm going to think? Yeah, no, I'm whoa. Yeah, all kinds of, it's appropriate imagery to use. I don't know if you can use this kind of imagery in Jacksonville, but for me, theologically, you're on thin ice at that point. Do you know what thin ice means?
Yeah,
thin ice means, how do I explain this to you?
Tenuous position.
Order too.
You do, okay. But I'm down in Florida. I mean, I'm that far south. Would they know what thin ice is?
How about swimming with the alligators?
Okay. I love it. You're swimming with the alligators. I want to say, I almost, see, the thing is, that rite of the of the Christmas vigil, that rite that happens on that eve, this is the feast of the church. But in North America, and less so elsewhere in the world, but in North American society, we've really made it a family rite. So are you going to be with your family tends to be the question. When I get asked, will you be with your family over Christmas, it reflects that kind of leaning rather than will you be with the church. And my mother has always insisted, this is the rite of the church. Christmas is the feast of the church. We gather with the church. So for me, that act, and I don't mean to be critical, but you asked, so...
Well, I'm critical also.
The act of individual families coming and saying, no, that just is reinforcing the idea that this is a family gathering. And we'll have many, many sincere Christians say, we don't get together with the church because Christmas is about family. Since when?
Yeah.
This is the feast of the church. This is high water, well, it's not the high, the ascension is, but this is the incarnation of our Lord.
Right.
Yikes, this, I want to be with the family of God. Of course I happen to sit with Joella and my sons.
Sure.
Yeah, of course. But it's the feast of the church, and I want my grandkids are getting it. They realize that that's where we start. Anything that we do as a family is derivative and flows out and comes after. But we do our family rites and practices around when the church has. I wish we met Christmas Day, but to my utter chagrin, the church where my son and his wife were intern pastors, because a year ago Christmas fell on Sunday, they actually canceled worship. They had no worship.
I have a little hard.
Whereas I would argue the other way, that on Christmas Day, regardless of what day it is, we should gather for worship. This is the feast day of the church.
But even if it were not on Christmas, I considered celebrating communion like that by families instead of the local congregation, even if it weren't on Christmas Eve.
Yeah, I struggle with it.
Yeah,
and I mean I do go up. Usually when I'm in an Anglican context, for example, I will move up with Joella. But once I get to the altar, we're not husband and wife. We're sister and brother in the faith. In a sense, we've moved into another dimension of reality here that anticipates the kingdom that is yet to come. We are not there as a couple. We are there as sisters and brothers in the faith. And my marriage, in a sense, is put in abeyance. Well, at that point, my primary affiliation is to the faith community. But our ecclesiology on this front is weak, and so we need to strengthen our ecclesiology to recognize it trumps family, it trumps church, it trumps everything. Every other social connection that we have is trumped by the phenomenon of the church. But when we view the church as just one of our many kind of connections, I'm at the Lions Club, I'm with family, I have a school alumni group, and then I cheer for Alabama, and then I'm also part of this church. It becomes just one of our social networks, and we try to juggle all of that rather than realizing that the church is indeed the baseline from which all of our lives are lived.
Gordon?
Yes.
Early on in my studies here, I encountered the term alternate Thanksgiving, which was what was called a service that ended not in the Lord's table, but in some other event that was a means of grace. Mm-hmm. Now, for us Pentecostal, that made me feel wrong.
Good.
We ended the altar service, which is different from an altar call. An altar service is different from an altar call. And it's very much a means of grace. What means of grace remains for the person who cannot get to the church for the public service? That, I'm referring to my private celebration of the Eucharist, you know, that I put together. But I mean, you've got homebound people, you've got prisoners, you've got, you know, all people who are just in situations where they cannot get to the assembled church.
Well,
is there a means of grace, an alternate Thanksgiving?
There is. One, I think we need to take it to them. So it's not that we say, well, you know, go down to the pop machine and make do. My point coming out of the last hour that we need to go to them is... I think it behooves us to find ways for them to be connected to this faith community, for those that are shut in and cannot come, and for all intents and purposes wanted to be here. But God is gracious in multiple ways. So we don't discount the means of grace that have been ordained, but if the ordained means of grace are not available to us, I want to say to those of us that are Baptistic in our understanding of the water rite, it would just be, for me, silly if I was living in the desert, somebody had come to faith, there's no oasis and there is no water. And unless I can immerse you, friend, you're just not good to go. So I guess you're just going to have to remain indefinitely unbaptized. I say, pshaw on that. We will find whatever water we've got, and whatever water we've got, we'll have to do. And the same thing with elderly people. Some of you have baptized elderly people, and you know if you immerse them, it would be a combination of a water rite and a burial rite. So, of course, you don't. So, yes, we can accommodate, but we recognize that these are the exceptions, not the norms. And in these contexts, typically we will speak to the norm. But God will surprise us in multiple ways. I mean, I get distressed in the Philippines when they use Coke and soda crackers as their communion elements. And I just say, well, they said, well, there was no grape juice or wine or proper bread available. I said, well, you could have been a little more creative than that. So you've got to go with what's available to you. At the same time, God can manifest His grace to us. I say I would like to have the Lord's Supper weekly, but I don't get it weekly. Whenever I don't get it weekly, God graciously surprises me with some means of grace that I did not see coming. But that does not mean that I can then say, well, then I guess I don't need it weekly because something will come. But when it's not there, some means of grace comes. Some surprising means to say, I'm still here looking out for you, Smith. But we don't presume upon grace when indeed the provision is made to us. We don't neglect what's been given to us.
On the subject of who can administer the sacraments or the ordinances, I'd like to get your reaction to something that I observed in our worship. A video of a mission team that went to reach an unreached people group in India. I can't remember the name of the people, but they had never heard of the name of Christ, okay? And very successful mission team, and they showed this one believer who had accepted Christ and one of our team, who was an ordained minister, baptizing him. And then this young man, in turn, went and led his friend to Christ. And when it came time for his friend to be baptized, they allowed the young man to baptize him rather than one of our ordained ministers that was on the trip. I mean, our congregation was like, oh, that's great, that's great, that's great, you know, but...
I would have leaned towards the ordained minister, but I'm not going to call that an inauthentic baptism. And if I had been in your company, you would never have known that I'd I would only express them here in this context of where we're doing critical theological reflection on the phenomena. I would lean that way, but I'm enough of a low churchman to say, I lean that way, but that doesn't make it an inauthentic baptism, not for a moment. And you would not have seen even a hint of hesitation on my part if I had been part of the community. I would have celebrated it all the way.
And of course it wasn't in a church, because there are no churches in this country, so it was in a river or a lake or whatever.
And appropriately so. Yeah. And it should be a flowing river according to Ambrose.
Yes.
The water should be moving.
Yes.
So you have to kind of keep the movement. This is an Ambrose. I'm learning Ambrose's theology here, having come to this institution.